I'm John Batchelor. Michael Vlahos of Johns Hopkins is here. This is the new John Batchelor Show, and Michael and I are having fun discussing a movie from 2000, the very successful Ridley Scott Gladiator, with a wonderful cast, Richard Harris playing Marcus Aurelius. Marcus Aurelius is dead in the movie. According to the movie, quite non-historical, he's slain by Commodus, who's played wonderfully by Joaquin Phoenix, a wonderful actor to project villainy and also ambition at the same time. Wonderfully well done. Marcus Aurelius is dead, and Commodus, in triumph, goes back to Rome and is welcomed by the Senate and the people of Rome in a scene that reminds many of Riefenstahl's scene of Nuremberg. So it's extremely well done to project the power of empire. Commodus, however, is not up to being emperor. In the fictional version, it's presented that Marcus Aurelius, before he's murdered by his son, meant to pass the responsibility of the empire to Maximus, our hero, our Spanish hero, Carthaginian Spanish hero. But it didn't happen. Maximus instead is ordered executed. He escapes. And now he has a revenge cycle because Joaquin Phoenix, a.k.a. Commodus, the new emperor who killed his father, ordered Maximus's family killed because he believed Maximus was wiped out as well. Maximus escaped. Now he has a revenge on Commodus. That becomes the movie, The Gladiator versus the Emperor. However, inside this, Derek Jacobi, the wonderful English actor, is assigned the role of being a senior sympathetic senator in the toga with the purple stripe. Wonderful. And there's a speech to Commodus in the palace, a fantastic palace, much bigger than anything you can imagine. I mean, the wonderful dimensions here, projecting empire in every instance, where Commodus is told by Derek Jacobi that it's time to return the empire to the Republic. This had been, according to the movie, an ambition of Marcus Aurelius's, turn it back to the people. And Derek Jacobi is obliged to say, the Senate represents the people. Michael, at that point, I laughed and called you up. That's why, Michael. The Senate represents the people. The Curia was the problem. How so, Michael?
Well, the Senate had always been the representation of aristocracy in Rome, originally with the patrician class, and then after 287 BC with the rising plebeians who became the optimates, the new men, the new aristocracy of Rome. And the optimates were like the billionaires today. They were definitely the 1% of Rome, maybe the 0.1%. And they were quite happy supporting the emperor just as the emperor supported them. And he doled out incredible imperial offices because there were a number of provinces that were reserved for senators to be governors only, not other administrators like generals. And as a result, you had a hand-in-glove sort of arrangement. And the original Republican aristocracy, or elite, better said, had transformed itself into the early and mid-empire into a rather stratified aristocracy, letting in very rich Greeks now as senators, beginning in the time of Marcus Aurelius, but nonetheless a ruling class. And the idea that somehow the Republic was an idea that this class was even capable of entertaining is, as you put it, laughable. And the obvious correlation is to the transformation, the very similar transformation, of American liberal elites into a new kind of aristocracy, just as stratified as, say, sending your child to Yale for $100,000 a year and guaranteeing his admission with a gift to the Yale endowment of, say, a million. That is very redolent of Rome as the stratification of aristocracy set in. And so the people who call themselves progressive in America are, in fact, very much like the senatorial elite that's very happy with a ruling class that's not only totally in control, but actually has its hands on all the levers of power.
Let's go back to the year 2000. That's an election year. Bill Clinton is finishing his a very successful, very popular term with, you know, there was turmoil, but it was his approval rating was in the 60s as he left office. The election is trouble. However, this movie comes out in May of 2000, before the election. And the idea that the Roman Senate was elected by the people and represented the people, Michael, that's the liberal progressive fantasy of the power of democracy right there. And Hollywood was giving to America what it believed about itself. We had defeated the Russians. The Soviets were gone. That was the unipolar world. Remember that, Michael? For a couple of years, either history was dead or it was unipolar, and we were overwhelmingly powerful. The trouble would start the next year with the 9/11 attack, but we were in a campaign mode now. There was reason to believe there's going to be continuity. Al Gore was a likely successor to Bill Clinton. So in May of 2000, what you're watching on the screen is very much America embracing America's success.
The short-lived narcissism of unipolarity was one of the great fantasies in American political life, and it was impenetrable at the time. One could say nothing against it, and the fact is that it replicated the similar fantasy that Roman elite had in the period we're talking about, from the time of Augustus to the time of Marcus Aurelius. There was still the fiction that on the death of a Roman emperor, the new emperor had to be acclaimed by the Roman Senate and the Roman people, and this was thought to be an absolute continuity of democratic-style republican norms going back to the founding of the Roman Republic in 509 B.C., you know, when you'd get all the 39 tribes of Rome together, and they would have to vote in through an elaborate process the new consul. Or I should say consuls, there were two. And in effect, these fantasies are an essential part of the myth-making that underscores legitimacy. And it was a necessary dispensation. A fantasy was needed to ratify the authority of succession in the Roman Empire. And it is so ironic today that without any historical reference that would allow people to come to terms with this recognition, that we today have become so much like the Roman Empire in the fantasy that we sustain about ourselves. In fact, to the point where democracy is one of the most constantly repeated terms in political discourse.
Let's have a moment here, Michael, to leaving Gaius and Germanicus in Londinium to come to Michael and John, our Christian names in the 21st century. Today, our Senate, the House and the Senate are versions of the Roman Senate in a building that is Roman and in a culture that embraces Roman institutions, certainly. These senators, these senator representatives, are surrounded by a Praetorian Guard, Michael, that's guarding them from the Germanic tribes. And again, I ask the ironic question, does Washington see it, that it's being guarded from its own people?
In Rome, the Praetorian Guards originally, you know, created by Tiberius, I guess, and their recruitment was primarily from Germans. And what we have today is a professional military that owes its existence and, in a sense, has pledged allegiance now to the American emperor and is being used as a force to sustain the power of the Roman American establishment. And right now there are 5,000 troops defending the American...
with metal detectors and wands to get to the floor to vote. That was my most recent information. And big gates around and nobody allowed close to the Capitol. Nobody allowed in for fear that those Germans are coming across the Danube, Malcolm. I mean, what we have here, Michael, is a movie projection of a movie.
Yes.
At the year 2000, except they've turned everything upside down.
The people talk about how, you know, the American military became an all-volunteer force, which was a kind of a fig leaf over what was in reality the replacement of a militia, right, Republican army in which all citizens were expected to defend the country to a military that was under total executive branch control. And that is exactly what happened to Rome after the end of the Republic. And the consequence of that is that the military as a force becomes paradoxically less powerful because it cannot fall back on all of the people to be a part of it and defend the nation, say as we did in World War II. It becomes less powerful, but also it becomes more dependent than ever on the very person of the emperor. And we can remember when George W. Bush, as president, would make many speeches in front of a military audience, and he would be in military uniform. I think the first president who would wear a military uniform as though he was a generalissimo, like Joseph Stalin or Adolf Hitler. You know, the idea that the president would be garbed as a Napoleon, it was a new development, and yet no one remarked upon it at the time.
Michael Vlahos.
I did.
Michael Vlahos of Johns Hopkins. Final thoughts, Michael, when we come back. Using Rome, is it agreeable for us to use Rome as a model for our questions about are we now in a civil war? With Michael Vlahos, I'm John Batchelor. This is the new John Batchelor Show.